Good afternoon. It is good to be with you. Come up here on occasion. I hope that maybe if my message is good enough, I'll be invited back. If not, it's kind of up for grabs. I did want to mention I was able to speak this morning to the Eastern European members. From Washington, D.C. I ended up my week in D.C., so I spoke with them this morning and didn't want me to. I said I was coming up here, so I'm supposed to give them her greetings. I know some of those people, actually, going way back many, many years ago, so it was good to see some of them. The title of my sermon today is The Valley of the Shadow of Death. The Valley of the Shadow of Death. You know, one of the most oft-quoted psalms, one of some 70 psalms that are attributed to King David, is Psalms 23. David authored many of them, and this one in particular, later in life. David was a complicated person. Complex individual. He was a warrior, he was a king, he was a shepherd, a songwriter, and much more. He was rich in experience, great in exploits, chief among sinners, the recipient of great mercy, chief among repenters, but still carries the title of being a friend of God, a man after God's own heart. I mean, that's a complicated, complex individual that loved God deeply, and God loved him. It is in this complexity, this dichotomy, this dramatic life that brings depth of meaning and the timeless nature of the words he wrote millennia ago. I'm going to quote it. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There is so much depth to these words. Actually, more has been written about the words than, actually, much more has been written about the words than the words themselves. So today I want to focus our attention, as I implied in my title, on just one phrase and bring relevance to it by showing how it has worked in the past, how it works for you and I today, and how it will yet shape the future. And that phrase is, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Now, there's this thing about shepherds that always kind of bothers me, because we had sheep. My brother was the care of sheep. We would have a local farmer give us his orphans, and we'd raise them on the bottle, and we always had sheep around, which are really convenient because they would eat all the weeds first. So it prevented me from having to hoe weeds in the pasture field where our horse was, which I thought was a really good idea because I didn't enjoy hoeing that much at that early age. But this casts a very different picture from what I call the Pollyannish poetic picture of the pastoral scene with a shepherd lazily sitting in the field and sheep just around him. It's just not reality. So I'm going to squash that right away, and I'm going to make a provocative statement. So here it comes. The provocative statement is this, that the valley of the shadow of death is actually more hellish than death itself. The valley of the shadow of death is more hellish than death itself. The phrase, the valley of the shadow of death, in Psalm chapter 23 comes from the Hebrew word Gethsemaneh. I probably pronounced that wrong. My Hebrew is not as good as my German. But suffice to say, here's the breakdown of its hellish and darker meaning. It is the abyss of mortal danger, symbolic of a place of near death or extreme peril. It is cosmic darkness. In Hebrew poetry, this word is often associated with thick darkness, chaos, death, and even demonic and spiritual danger. Third definition is spiritual desolation. The phrase can be read as a metaphor for utter despair or godless abandonment, which some interpret as, quote, hellish. It should maybe not surprise us that this word is most often used in the book of Job. Have you ever read the book of Job? You know, the sons of God came together around his throne, and Satan also showed up, and God asked him where he's from. He said, oh, from going to and fro on the face of the earth. And God pointed out to him, Job, have you seen Job, my servant? And of course, Satan said, I mean, you've blessed him, you know, take away his stuff and, you know, he will curse you to your face. And then God allowed Satan to do his work, and you know the story. So let's just take a look. I'll point out a couple of things on this verse. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Now, back to the statement that I made, if the valley of the shadow of death is worse than death itself, this is almost a contradictory statement. I will fear no evil, even in this valley of the shadow of death. So the first thing we can deduce from this statement is that it's the valley of the shadow of death, I think, implies that is something that you have to walk through. And anytime you walk through something, it comes with a period of time. And in contrast to death, I mean, the time leading up to death can sometimes be long, but death itself is a cutoff point that brings, it has its own sting and all of that, but there is the, shall we say, the benefit of closure. The second thing we see in this particular phrase is that we are to fear no evil. Now, the Hebrew word for evil in this case is it's a simple word, so I can pronounce it, ra. And it is used throughout the Old Testament for evil, but it is also, from a phonetic construct standpoint, the name of an Egyptian deity, a sun god, no less. And then thirdly, we have Yedo, I walk, and it's almost the Hebrew equivalent to the modern so what. You know, if I change out the words a little bit, you know, so what if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. So you have this dramatic contrast. So what if I walk through this hellish chasm called the shadow of death? I will still fear no evil, nor the wrath even of an Egyptian sun god. So why did or could David say this? The answer is actually in the very next verse. For you are with me, David wrote. For you are with me. Let's go take a look at, David described this over in Psalm chapter 139, Psalm 139, beginning in verse 7, he writes, where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, Even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely darkness shall fall on me, even a night shall be light about me. So David understood that, you know, God was, to use a big word, omnipresent. He's always there. And he makes it, I think he brings tangibility to the words that we just read here in Psalms 139. But let's look at what Jesus said. Jesus said over in Matthew chapter 18, Matthew 18, in verse 20, Matthew 18, in verse 20, he says, "For where two or three are gathered in my name, I will be there in the midst of them." So this promise of being there with you, even in the valley of shadow of death, we think about things in terms of size of audiences and all of that, and there is strength in size. I don't want to take away from that. But the promise that God made, or that Jesus made in this particular case, is if you have two. And the condition is, if they are assembled in my name, I will be there. I mean, that's a pretty low bar when you think about it. It's a really low bar. And it reminds me of the encounter, I think this is in Luke, where the disciples, ever seeking to be special and seeking power, came to him and says, "Lord, you know, there was this guy over there, and he was casting out demons in your name." I mean, that's no small feat. "And we told him to stop, you know, because," why? "Because he does not follow with us," right? And Jesus had a different perspective. He said, look, if they are not against us, they're for us. No, knock it off. So you go back here and you look at this and you say, okay, this is a relatively low bar. And, you know, Matthew 18 has a number of things to say. You know, the disciples also weren't that keen about little ones. And let's just look at verse 10. "Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." Little ones. So this emphasizes the ever-present and nature and the willingness of God to be with us. But perhaps the classic example, I'm sure there could be others, but perhaps the classic one of walking through the valley of the shadow of death and the Lord being with him is in the life and story of Joseph. You know, Joseph is one of those individuals, one of two actually, of which you can't find much fault. Now, he did have that coat of many colors, and he did have this issue with dreams, which we'll read here in a minute. The other one is Daniel. But the remarkable thing that the refrain that we will see in Joseph's journey through his difficult life, through the valley of the shadow of death, was the refrain, "And the Lord was with him." And I've always thought, you know, if the Lord was with him, you know, who needs enemies in a situation like that? But let's go to the text. Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 3. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors." I mean, this is a great way to start a family feud. Just give preference. See how that works out for you. Well, He documented his preference by making him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him, and he could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph dreamed a dream and told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So this I think was the fault of Joseph. You know, this was at least not wise. I had a dream. You know, there have been famous speeches given like that. He said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, a sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaves." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream. You know, let's not, if we're going to stoke this, let's really pour it on, you know. I had another dream. So he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and even his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers also come bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in his mind. So then, they were shepherds by occupation, and this also shows, I mean, there was so much drama in this family, if you pay attention to all the stuff that went on, you know, it's pretty interesting. So they took their livestock, and Israel sent, or Jacob sent Joseph, his favorite son, to go check on him. They hated him. And Joseph went there in full uniform. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? You know, he went there in full uniform to check up on him. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem, and a certain man found him there wandering in the field, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm checking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went to after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him. So they were going to make good on the hateful emotions that they had now harbored with them for a long period of time. So Reuben intervened and told them, don't do this. I mean, it's not a good idea. Let's put him in a well. You know, just put him in a well and hold him up there. He had a different plan, but Reuben, being the coward that he was, didn't confront his brothers. He was going to lift him out later and send him back to his father, as the story tells us. But Judah wanted to make a business deal. He said, "Look, why? What profit is it to sell our to kill our brother if we can sell him?" So they pulled him out and sold him to traders that were coming through the land. And Joseph ultimately went down to Egypt, which we'll pick up the story there. But it was also Judah who took the uniform, if you will, the coat of many colors, and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the garment into the blood, and then they sent this garment to his father and said, "Hey, we found this." "No, you didn't. We found this. Do you know who this is from?" And of course, Jacob was easily identified it as the tunic of his favorite son, Joseph, and mourned and was grieved because he said a wild beast has certainly killed Joseph. So you look at that and you say, you know, this is how people do things in order to try to, I mean, this is deception. You know, here's the coat, you decide. You know, they didn't say what happened to him, but they deceived their father on what happened with their brother. So let's go to chapter 39. I was looking at this morning, and I read chapter 38, and I thought, you know, what a mess. You know, chapter 38 has another account. In verse 1 of chapter 39, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there, and the Lord was with Joseph." So we have that statement. You know, he got sold to the Ishmaelites who then sold him to this officer in Pharaoh's house in Egypt for a profit. But the statement here is that the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and it was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. So he prospered him, even in this dark valley that he was walking through at the time. "And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did prosper in his hands." Now think about that. This was a Hebrew young man. I think Joseph was, if I remember right, something like 18 or 20 years old. I'm not sure about that. You can check on ChatGPT, and it'll probably tell you very quickly. That's just what comes to mind at the moment. But that's not the point here. The point is not his age. The point is that the officer in Pharaoh's house recognized that the Lord was with him. His example was so sterling, and his dedication and performance, even though he was enslaved, that this Egyptian recognized that the Lord was with him. I mean, I think is instructive. And then, of course, he had quite a wife, this officer of the Egyptians who was attracted to Joseph. And let me see here. "So Joseph," verse 4, "found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of the house, and all that he had he put into his hand." So it was from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate, and Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. "Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has in my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against Elohim?" So Joseph was a young man of character to the point that he was not concerned so much about you know, the relationship. I mean, it would have been human to say, well, look, I mean, I've got it. For my situation, it's about as good as it can get. You know, I'm here in Egypt. I'd rather be home with my father, but I can't do that. I'm a slave, but for a slave, it doesn't get much better. But that wasn't, and if I have an affair with this wife, I mean, this could go really badly for me. That wasn't his primary concern. He said, how could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? His character flowed from the fact that he was a, to put it in modern terms, a God-fearing man. And, I mean, you know the story. One day he was in the house with her alone, and she grabbed a hold of him, and he left the tunic in his hand and fled. And here you go again. He did the right thing, and there was no right to due process like we're used to in the United States. And once again, he found himself in prison. So it was when his master heard the words of his wife and spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. But the Lord was with Joseph. I mean, seriously? I mean, I did the right thing, and now I find myself in prison, all locked up. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in it. And whatever they did there, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. I mean, you could look at it here and say, okay, I mean, they took advantage of him. Advantage of his diligence. And then there were the prisoner's dreams. So the dreamer met his compatriots who also had dreams. And it came to pass that after these things, that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt defended their lord, and the king of Egypt, and Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody of the house, and the captain of the guard in the prison in the place where Joseph was confined. And a captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them, so they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker, the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came to them in the morning and looked at them, and they were sad. So they had this dream about bread and the dream about wine. I mean, I guess, you know, that's appropriate, because there was the cupbearer and also the baker. So the cupbearer first told Joseph his dream, and Joseph interpreted it, and the interpretation was this: the three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show me the kindness to me to make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me in this dungeon. Of course, the butler promptly forgot about this request when it went well for him. I mean, it's just the way human nature works. Things didn't go so well for the baker. He was executed the next day. But let's go to verse 9. I'd like to pick up the story here in verse 3. Verse 2. I keep changing my mind. Suddenly they came, Pharaoh had a dream, and he stood by the river. Suddenly they came up out of the river, seven cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. And behold, seven other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows in the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the seven fine-looking and fat cows, so Pharaoh awoke. And then he had another dream with the same meaning. Verse 9, then the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, because nobody else could interpret the dreams. I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servant and put me in custody of the house, and we each dreamed dreams. Now there was a young Hebrew with me there, and the servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us, and each man and he interpreted it according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened, he restored me to my office, and he hanged him. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved and changed his clothing and came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is no one who can interpret, but I have heard it said of you that you can understand dreams to interpret them. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Then Pharaoh told Joseph the dreams. And Joseph interpreted them and told him that the seven ears and the seven cows represent 7 years of plenty. And subsequently, the seven gaunt cows and the seven dried up ears represented 7 years of drought. And so the advice in verse 37 was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this man in whom is the Spirit of God? Now, this is the, you know, this is the common theme through here. And it tells us something about how, on a practical manner, we can walk through the valley of the shadow of death and how God is with you. It says here, in the Spirit of God was so evident in the person of Joseph that the Pharaoh of Egypt recognized it. And he promoted Joseph to becoming his right-hand man and basically put him in authority over all of Egypt to manage the food gathering and storage during the 7 years so that they would be able to overcome the drought. Now, it went just as had been predicted. And the famine was bad throughout the whole region. Enter chapter 42. And when Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? You know, get off your, you know what. And he said, indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold it to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brother came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Just as the dreamer had dreamed. And Joseph said to his brothers, saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And he said to them, where do you come from? And he said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them, and he said to them, you are spies, and you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. We are honest men, the sons of one father. But he said to them, no, but you have come to be a spy. And they said, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke, you are spies, and in this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested, to see whether there is any truth in you, or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison 3 days, and Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. And I'm going to summarize here for lack of time. So he sent them on their way, kept one back, put the money into their bags, and they went back home with the understanding that you better not show your face down here unless you bring your younger brother to prove that you are honest men. You see, as the Psalm 23 continues, there's the next statement after, for I will be with you. The next statement is, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The rod and the staff of the shepherd is not this cane with the, well, I mean, it can be a cane with a crook, but it's to reach out and to pull sheep around and also to knock knots and heads of wolves and other things like that. It's, again, I say that simply to squash this Pollyannish idea of what shepherding really looks like. So their justice was about to happen. Dr. Jordan Peterson says something that I've found to be, I mean, he says a lot of things, but one of the things that he has said that I think is relevant here, he says, the consequence of telling the truth. Now that's an interesting, there's some tension in that statement, the consequence of telling the truth. I mean, we would tend to say, I mean, the reward for telling the truth, the consequence of telling the truth is always going to lead to the best outcome. How could it be any different? There are times, I mean, the human nature would tell us, well, you know, rather than telling the whole truth, I will, you know, couch it in order to avoid consequence. But even, I mean, one of the most noted psychologists in contemporary psychologists, I should say, notes that, no, ultimately, it all comes out in the wash. My dad used to say that God's mill, I have to translate into English, mill, God's mill, flour mill, grinds very, very slow, but fine. The idea was, behind it is, look, I mean, things come out in the wash. So, Genesis chapter 42, Joseph's brothers go down to Egypt, and, you know, they have this discussion with him. They didn't recognize him. He recognized them. The next statement in this psalm is, you prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, and you anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. That what we see here in the story of Joseph maps seamlessly across what you see here in Psalm 23. You walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Joseph did that. The Lord was with him time and again. Justice was ultimately served. The rod represents that. And then he got to see, I mean, this whole preparation of the table in the presence of his enemies. I mean, his brothers were his enemies. They literally sold him. They hated him. That's usually what happens, you know, people hate enemies. Genesis chapter 43, you know, there's the whole, you remember the story, they take the food, the grain back, they have their money back in the bag. They didn't realize that until they were back, and they kept telling his father, you know, Benjamin's going to have to come with us. And he of course didn't want him to go. And finally, Judah, it's interesting, Judah became surety for him. And after a while, his father relented, and they went down to see him. So let's look at Genesis chapter 43. This is a long story, actually. When you look at it, I think this story of Joseph occupies more pages in the book of Genesis than any other single story. So I'm kind of jumping through here. Now we could do what, you know, Nehemiah did. You know, you go from morning to midday. We can go from noon to supper, but I won't do that. So they came in front of Joseph once again, and they served up food. In verse 34, then he took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as much as of the others. So they drank and were merry with him. I mean, at least they were going to enjoy the party together. And Joseph commanded the steward of the house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money. So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. And as soon as morning dawned, the men went on their way. And when they had gone out from the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to the steward, go, get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination, and you have done evil in so doing? So he overtook them, and he spoke these words to them, and they said, why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servants would do such a thing. Look, we brought back your money from the land of Canaan, the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever your servant it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves. They spoke condemnation to themselves, and each man speedily let down his sack to the ground and opened each sack. So he searched, and he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, each man loaded his donkey, and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you have done? Did you not know such a man as I could certainly practice divination? Then Judah said, what shall we say, my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found. But he said, far be it from me that I should do so, but the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave, and as for you, go back in peace to your father. Then Judah came near to him and said, oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in the Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child in his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him. And we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with us, you shall see my face no more. So it was when we went up to your servants, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord, and our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down if our youngest brother is with us. Then we went down, for we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. The one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I will bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? I mean, I don't know how to improve on this story. I mean, the drama of it. It is so dramatic. The tables turned. What Peterson, the psychologist, observed plays out in actuality. The consequence of lying, you also don't escape. You also don't escape. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? It is a remarkable turn of events that will have, I mean, the sons of Joseph today don't know who they are either. At some point, they will say, I am Joseph, your brother. But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. And he came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourself because you sold me here, for God sent me here before you to preserve life. For these 2 years of famine, this famine has been in the land. There are still five in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting, and God sent me before you to preserve posterity for you in the earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance. They went back. Joseph sent provisions. Jacob came down, and, you know, it was a dramatic reunification. In Genesis chapter 44 and 45, Joseph extends mercy. 46, Jacob goes to Egypt. 47, Jacob dwells in Egypt. And it's interesting. They were shepherds. And this is instructive from a cultural standpoint. The Egyptians considered shepherds an abomination. The Egyptians are the quintessential example of tyrannical rulership, pyramidal in structure. I mean, these are, maybe I'm getting old, but I mean, of late when I've been reading the Bible, you have these patterns that just keep replaying themselves down through history, and you can't go against it. Ultimately, as we see in this case, Justice is done and God's purpose is fulfilled. Chapter 48, Jacob blesses and adopts Joseph's sons. Let's go there. I'll just digress here a moment, but I think sometimes we forget, you know, Joseph had an Egyptian wife. So, hence, Jacob adopts, maybe I'll just paraphrase this, he adopted Ephraim and Manasseh. And, you know, this is one of the reasons I think it was so difficult for the Israelites to leave Egypt behind. I mean, it was, in the case of Ephraim, Manasseh literally bred in him. I mentioned I was in D.C. this morning, is where I ended up. I took a trip down there, the little Amish Mennonite group. They literally begged me to go along, and finally I said, I'm so busy. And this is Susan's sister's nephew. It's one of them. It's all in the family. I think there was a TV show by that name. He guilted me into going. And finally I said, okay, I'll go. So I did. And we had a tour guide who has spent something like 20 years researching Freemasonry, which, I mean, I think we used to have a booklet about, you know, the occultic nature of Freemasonry. And I found it quite remarkable. So we were in D.C. yesterday, and you know, D.C. is laid out as a 10-mile block, and we went to the cornerstone on the southernmost point. And you know, this guy said, "Well, you know, the Masons consecrated this cornerstone for the District of Columbia using Scottish Mason rites and consecrated with oil, corn, and wine." And his point was, you know, this is syncretism, and, you know, it's deeply embedded. You have, on the one hand, you know, the Judeo-Christian aspects of it, and then on the other, you have this stuff mixed in, which was, you know, emblematic, actually, of what the northern tribes did, especially Jeroboam. I mean, he moved the feast to the eighth month. He moved, at least there's an indication that he moved the Sabbath to the eighth day. That's not quite as conclusive. The second thing, we then went to the Capitol, and this our tour guide had been there in 1993 when they celebrated the 200th anniversary of the laying of the cornerstone. George Washington, in full Scottish Mason garb, again, this cornerstone was laid and consecrated with Masonic rituals. Now, we were there yesterday, and I had told him, I said, a lot of geopolitical and significant events, I know this from Dr. Sherritt, happened in and around the Holy Days. So, as we were there at the southernmost stone, I quickly Googled it. And wouldn't you know, that cornerstone was laid on the 11th day of Abib in 1791, which is the day after when you should go out and, you know, consecrate the Passover lamb. So it was right in the season of Passover. The tour guide was quite amazed. He said, "Well, what day on the Hebrew calendar was the cornerstone of the Capitol?" So I looked that up, and the cornerstone of the Capitol was laid in the afternoon preceding the Feast of Trumpets in 1793. You know, you say, well, maybe that's coincidental. But I think the lesson here is that the sons of Joseph today, which we understand us to be, still have, I mean, if you know anything about Freemasonry, it's Egyptian occultic rites. I mean, they even say that if you Google it, or you can see that. It's still here. We were founded on some of these things, and it just continues to follow us. But that's I can see a message coming. The significance of the southern, the southernmost cornerstone, and I want to do a little bit more research to make sure the conclusions follow. So Jacob blesses and adopts Joseph's sons. He also blesses the progeny of all 12 sons for the latter days, and you know, you see modern fulfillment in all that. Even though the tribes are lost, we know from prophetic scripture and even the book of Revelation, you know, you have the 144,000 that are mentioned twice, and you have 12,000. So these people have to exist at the return of Jesus Christ, and subsequently will go into the land of Israel, the start of which we see today. I mean, the nation of Israel, actually it's the nation of Judah, if you want to be precise, after World War II, it continues to be built up, and it continues to be a stumbling stone. Chapter 50, Joseph dies and mourns, and Joseph had to reassure his brothers because they were still afraid. They were going to, as Joseph is going to exact revenge. The final statement in Psalm chapter 23 is that I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And here's where we're going to conclude. So I think it is encouraging to see how this maps, and you know what it will do for you, being that God is the same God yesterday, today, and forever. There will be justice. You cannot jump over your shadow and lie your way and escape. I mean, you be sure your sin will find you out. I mean, that is the lesson that one of the many lessons we can draw from this. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And if you look at the family of Jacob, I mean, they had just about, I mean, I think it's fair to say that they represent the quintessential dysfunctional family. I mean, there were four women, imagine that. There were, Jacob wasn't exactly a man of character, because he ended up having sexual relations with his daughter-in-law, and he legitimized it because she presented herself as a, as we would say in modern days, a hooker. But despite all that, I mean, I say this to all of us that have our challenges, because I mean, you really can't. I can't think of a scenario that's worse. And yet, David wrote, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Come with me to Ezekiel chapter 37, last scripture. Ezekiel chapter 37. You know, we have, I'll sketch this out. You have the Valley of the Dry Bones, and bones come together, and it's a big, I always like this. I mean, you talk about a reassembly process. What you see here in verse 12 of 37 is, therefore prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord, behold my people, I will open your graves, and cause you to come up from your graves, and bring you into the land of Israel. I mean, if you, this is a concise, succinct statement that covers a vast expanse of humanity, or I should say a vast expanse of Israelites, from the ancient Israelites to the modern day. Then you shall know that I am the Lord, when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up from your graves. I will put my spirit in you, and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I am the Lord, that I, the Lord, have spoken it and performed it, says the Lord. So, the extent to which God will go to restore a people, a dysfunctional family, is unbelievably remarkable. He brings them up out of their graves, and most people jump to the erroneous conclusion that this is judgment, and indeed it is, but the purpose that is stated here is, I bring you up out of your graves to put my spirit in you, and I will place you in your own land, so that I can dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Verse 15, and the word of the Lord came to me, saying, as for you, son of man, take the stick for yourself and write on it Judah, and for the children of Israel and his companions, take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions. Then you join them one to another for yourself into one stick, and they will become one in your hand. And when the children of Israel, your people, speak to you, saying, will you not show us what this means? Say to them, thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will join them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be in my hand. And the sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes. Then they shall say, then you shall say to them, thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, wherever they have gone, and will gather them from every side, and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land of Israel on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all, and they shall no longer be divided, no longer be two nations, nor shall they ever be divided into two kingdoms again. They shall not defile themselves any more with their idols, nor their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Verse 24, David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. Then they shall dwell in the land which I have given to Jacob my servant, where your fathers dwelled, and they shall dwell there, they and their children and their children's children forever. My servant David shall be their prince forever. What David penned in poetic verse becomes literally true and an eternal reality when you map it across the words of the prophets. And that is why David could say, yea, though, so what, if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. He could say that. You and I can say that, because we can see that in the future, this will work out.